This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll hear from a visionary in medicine with news about how technology will forever change the face of medical care as we know it. But first, in our What's Your Emergency segment, Dr. Derek Cooney, Director of Emergency Medical Services and Disaster Medicine, and his colleague, Dr. William Paolo, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University, talk about skin infections and why they can be dangerous.
Some infections of the skin are pretty minor, like acne, diaper rash, and tinea, or athlete's foot, or ringworm. And those can be treated at home or with over-the-counter medications or when you see your primary care doctor. I thought we'd focus on the more difficult skin infections for a moment and then talk about some more life-threatening ones. So, you know, can you give us a rundown? What are the common things we see in the emergency department?
Well, we see a gamut of different skin infections, really, that run from viral, such thing as zoster, colloquially known as shingles, which is caused by the chickenpox virus that lives in your nerves for the rest of your life after you get it. And then after stress or immune compromise or various other insults to the body, you can then reactivate it. So we see those in what we call a dermatome, which is the area supplied by a single nerve. And what it looks like is chickenpox again, but it looks like it's only going in a line around the body or potentially around the eye, which is when we're more concerning. If it reactivates on the face, we always worry that it can involve the eye. So we want to see you sooner, either in the emergency department or at your primary care doctor, because actually the quicker that we treat you after you have those lesions or the appearance of them, the quicker we can actually make it resolve.
And that can be red, it can be painful, it can even break up. And you can even get, if you scratch at it or break it open, you can get a bacterial infection too. That's so you can get bacteria and a virus.
That's right, that's right. What we talk about is looking like a dewdrop on a rose petal. So it looks like an elevated area with clear fluid. It's what we call a vesicle. So it's a fluid-filled pocket, and underneath it looks red. So that's kind of the chickenpox appearance that most people would describe.
Right. And what about, the other thing we talk about is bacterial infections. And what about when they show up on children or even adults, you know, on the face and impetigo is one of the things they talk about.
Yeah.
What is impetigo?
So impetigo is a staph infection that can occur.
Which means bacterial
it's a
infection.
Yes, it's a bacterial infection caused by the bacteria named Staph aureus. And it can occur anywhere. In kids, we mostly see it on the face. And we see it in kids who have things like eczema. And we see it in kids who drool a lot because they have breakdowns in their skin. They have breakdown in their skin and their mucous membranes. And then it allows the bacteria that live on everybody's skin to then get in and infect. And what we call those are kind of honey-crusted lesions, because they look like the appearance of honey. It's actually the effects of some of the toxins that the bacteria forms, and it gives this reddish honey-colored appearance. If we see that, it can be treated a number of ways, sometimes topically, and sometimes it will require oral antibiotics as well.
So either an antibiotic cream or an ointment, or sometimes there is a need for a prescription, isn't there?
That's correct. Usually the antibiotic ointment that we use is a prescription strength. So we'll either use that by itself or in combination with an oral antibiotic as well.
So we mentioned parasites. You know, we don't usually think about parasites when we think of skin infections, but actually pretty common parasitic skin infections like scabies or pediculosis. And
yeah,
those are fancy words. Why don't you tell us what those really are?
Yeah, so scabies are a type of mite, really, that live, that can transmit from person to person, and they burrow underneath the skin. Usually what we see it is in between your fingers or in between your toes is kind of a port of entry that they get underneath your skin. And then they burrow and make more of them. So they make little eggs underneath your skin, as gross as that sounds. And then you get a reaction to it and you get very itchy because of the way your body's reacting to it. And you can see redness, scaling, and itchiness. And what we call burrows, which look like little red streaks that start from the area that they've entered. And we look for that area to kind of tell us what is scabies. Pediculosis, which you mentioned, is really another infestation that can occur usually in any area, particularly areas of what we see apocrine sweat glands, and that's in your armpit and that's in your pubic hair as well. So we can see little mites. The same things that cause lice really are the same things that we're seeing. It's just a matter of where you get that infection.
Right. So on the body, and you know, people are pretty familiar with head lice, but but you can have it on your body and other places
as
well.
Yes, you can.
So, and then the other thing that's relatively common we see that really does need treatment, and sometimes, you know, the emergency department is the best place for this, is, believe it or not, is a paronychia and the felon, right? A bacterial infection of the fingertip or at the edge of the nail. Tell the audience what we do with that.
Yeah, so a paronychia is a fancy term for an infection at the edge of the nail itself, whereas a felon kind of involves what we call the pulp of the finger, which is that fat part on the bottom of your finger where your fingerprints are. These are caused by any number of things, but what we see a lot of times are people who bite their nails, and it provides a nice portal of entry for a bacteria that already is living on your skin to get underneath your skin and start infecting it. A paronychia would look like a big growth, almost looks like an ingrown fingernail, and it's red, and sometimes it's draining kind of a milky fluid that we call pus, whereas a felon looks like a swelling of the entire distal part of the finger, which is the end of your finger, and you can see that swollen, red, and painful.
Yeah, and we'll have to, if that's the case, we have to drain those, because antibiotics alone won't usually cure those up, so typically you'll have to have an injection, unfortunately, so you won't feel the pain when we have to open that to allow it to drain, and then close follow-up will be required. If you're just joining us, I'm Dr. Derek Cooney, and Dr. Willem Paolo is joining me to discuss skin infections. We've just discussed some skin infections that need therapy, and we can treat those in the emergency department, but don't usually rise to the level of serious or potential life-threatening infections. I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about skin abscesses. And, of course, those are pockets of infection that have walled off and can become large, red, swollen, and painful. These are usually filled with bacteria and pus, like the paronychia that Bill was mentioning, and they don't respond to antibiotics alone either. And why is that? What makes them different than a regular bacterial infection that we'd treat with antibiotics?
Well, abscesses, as you mentioned, are walled off. So it means the body has tried to keep it in one particular anatomical location. And part of the problem of that is that the blood doesn't circulate there as well, so we have a little bit more trouble getting antibiotics to penetrate into that pocket that your body has made to protect itself. So in order to get to it, a lot of times we have to get to it through the surface, and that's through what we call an incision and drainage. What that means is that pocket of pus is not going to get better because it's filled with bacteria and toxins that the bacteria make in white blood cells. So what we do is we have to make a little incision and allow that a portal of entry to the surface to drain. And after we do that, we'll usually irrigate it out to get rid of all the bacteria, and then allow that to heal, because once you get rid of the bacteria in that area, that typically takes care of it without the need for antibiotics, because once it's drained, we've gotten rid of the problem and we don't actually need to treat it anymore.
Right. And when you come to the emergency department, you may need an injection to also numb that up. They might take a culture if it's something unusual, and a culture, of course, is to grow and see what kind of bacteria it is in the lab. We don't always do that. But you also might need to consider the fact that in some cases the abscesses are bad enough to require what we call sedation, so medications to sort of put someone almost to sleep to allow the procedure, and that sometimes occurs with children. In some cases and in some locations, abscesses are so bad that we have to call a surgeon and they have to go to the operating room just from an abscess, right?
Yeah, there's some particular areas that are worrisome, particularly in the groin, around the genitals, and on the abdomen themselves. And then there are those that can occur around the rectum itself. And these are particular sensitive locations because of where those tissues can communicate with. In other words, where the abscess can travel to. It can travel into the stomach, it can travel into the tissues around the groin or into the rectum itself. And we really worry about those areas in particular.
So those are abscesses. And then what about just redness of the skin that's from a bacteria and there's no abscess? That's cellulitis, right? We've seen that. You can see your regular doctor for that and get treated. Some cellulitis, though, isn't what we call superficial cellulitis. It's deep. It's gone into the deeper tissues, into the deep parts of the skin. And sometimes you need more than just oral antibiotics. So what would we do if we saw that in the emergency department?
Yeah, so cellulitis is a superficial skin infection, so we can see redness and warmth with that. And we can treat that typically with antibiotics. That's caused, again, by the two bacteria, staph and strep, typically. Now, the deeper one that you're talking about that we worry about sometimes that people commonly referred to as the flesh-eating bacteria. This is what we call necrotizing fasciitis. A lot of times we might not see any skin infection at all because it's in the deeper tissue. So sometimes we can feel a little popping when we touch your skin because of the air pockets that form. And sometimes you just might feel really sick and have pain in a limb and otherwise look really sick, almost like you have the flu and have a lot of pain in the area where that infection is. And that, if you do have that, is very serious and will require you to see us and to see a surgeon as well.
Right, and that flesh-eating bacterial infection we call necrotizing fasciitis usually requires a lot of tests in the emergency department. There'll be a lot of fast work to get the patient to the operating room. And then, of course, the studies show that something called hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which we've talked about before, is a special modality not available everywhere.
Yeah.
Fortunately, in this community, we do have that at our hospital, and that improves overall outcome and morbidity and mortality, which is the risk of dying from this very serious infection.
Correct. In spite of the news reports about it and all the headlines about it, it's not that common. So we really worry about it in people who are diabetic, immunocompromised, or might have things like being treated for cancer. These make us more worried, though it can happen in people otherwise healthy, though it is very rare.
So if you notice something that looks like a serious infection or a redness or a pain, you may need to find yourself in the emergency department to evaluate for these serious conditions. Bill, that's all the time we have, and I thank you for joining me again.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Lessons from my mom's nursing home for you and me for our nursing home stay. Well, folks, the fastest growing age group in the United States is the very old, people 90 and up. Hallmark sales of happy 100th birthday cards exceeded 75,000 a year recently. And the older one gets, the older one is likely to get, because we've dodged all the bullets that can kill us as youngins. My father lived to 78, but statistics say he probably would have gone to 88 if he hadn't smoked. My mother is, goodness gracious, 97. So I've got good odds of blowing out lots of candles on my birthday cake. Now, if you sharpen up your pencil and do the math, you can probably predict fairly well how many candles you'll see on your cakes. Why is this so important? Because if we make it to 85, there's a 50-50 chance that we'll develop Alzheimer's, and ever-rising odds of physical disability, too. My mom has Alzheimer's, has for at least 10 years, going downhill mentally, but only been in a nursing home for the last two. I visit once a week. Sometimes she doesn't know my name, introduces me as her husband or her brother. Recently, she clocked me one for who knows why. Often when she first sees me, she lights up and runs to me, as a 97-year-old can run, and her delight is heartwarmingly delightful. What am I learning from my visits there? Well, first, the emotional cost of caring for someone with Alzheimer's, even if the person's in a good home and sometimes delightful, is staggering. The most stressful thing I've ever dealt with. Second, most people in nursing homes have Alzheimer's, but some very old people are sharp and vibrant and pleasant, physically disabled somehow, but for my money, on the better side of that 50-50 split. Third, nursing homes, no matter how good the staff and setting, are not much fun despite everyone's best efforts. Finally, I've learned that there are things one can do to shift the odds in our favor of staying out as long as possible and maybe, fingers crossed, never getting to a nursing home. Some are obvious. Drive carefully and keep our blood pressure in check to avoid a stroke. And my friend, Dr. Sharon Brangman, head of Upstate Gerontology, tells me only a tiny fraction of Alzheimer's is genetic. The best bets for keeping our noodling happily along are a Mediterranean-style diet, regular moderate exercise like brisk walking, and staying intellectually and socially active. And regular exercise, and all those other things too, go a long way to keeping us free from physical disability too. I'll take the exercise bike and treadmill and dance floor and plain old walking shoes over the wheelchair any day. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, how technology will forever change the face of medical care. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Most people who work in healthcare are continually looking for ways to improve the industry. And recently at Upstate, faculty and staff had the chance to hear from a man who believes that we can figure out a way to better deliver healthcare at a cheaper price. Dr. Kent Bottles also made time to stop into HealthLink on Air. He's a physician executive who has held leadership positions in academia, biotechnology, and community health systems, and he has some ideas about what the future holds for medicine. Well, let's start talking about some of the struggles that we're facing in healthcare today in terms of the costs and the efficiency. I mean, we're spending so much on healthcare, and yet we seem to be maybe not having the best healthcare. Is that true? What's your experience?
I think that's true. And I think if you take an environmental scan of what's happening in healthcare today, we spend about $2.5 trillion on healthcare in the United States. And that's a lot of money. And it's, last time I checked, was about 18% of GDP, gross domestic product. And yet, we're not ranked number one in the world in measurable outcomes, such as infant mortality or how long we live. So it looks like we're spending the most money of anybody in the world and not really getting the best healthcare that's out there. The other thing is that if we spend money on healthcare, that's money we don't have to spend on the environment, on protecting our borders, on defense, or on education. So money that if it's wasted in healthcare, then we don't have it for these other things that seem to be important. And as I look around the country today, many of us are very concerned about the federal budget deficit. Mm-hmm. I don't know about New York, but most states have a huge budget deficit. And so now the state governors are looking at cutting Medicaid.
That's New York for sure.
Okay. So that's applicable in California and Pennsylvania and New York. And so I look at that and I say, wow, that's a problem. But I'm not that depressed. I mean, I'm actually very hopeful because I think there's a lot of new technology or disruptive technologic tools such as smartphones or such as even smart robots or social media networks that we really haven't thought very clearly about how they could be used to make healthcare better. So although I think that the challenges are really, really large, and I think it's clear that we're going to have to decrease the per capita cost of healthcare and increase the quality, I'm actually fairly sanguine that if we really roll up our sleeves, we can figure out a way to better deliver healthcare at a cheaper price.
Well, the one thing that strikes me is very problematic that goes with the program in this country is that as we continue to have greater and greater medical breakthroughs in terms of what's available to people, it's harder and harder to capitate that, to then say to the public, well, you can't have this care. And so there seems to be a real mismatch then in how we control these costs.
But be careful. More care isn't always better. And you've got to take a look at the Winberg-Dartmouth small area variation studies. And let me just give you one example. In the last 2 years of life in Newark, New Jersey, people spend 35 days in the hospital. In Portland, Oregon, and Salt Lake City, it's 7 or 8 days. So, and the outcomes are the same. The people are dead. So how can we teach the people in Miami or in Newark, New Jersey to practice medicine the way they practice it at Mayo Clinic or in Salt Lake City or in Portland? I mean, that the Dartmouth's Atlas is really interesting. Per capita expenditures for healthcare in South Dakota, last time I looked, was the cheapest, about $5,500 per person per year. In Miami, Florida, it was over $15,000. And yet the actual measurable outcomes are better in the upper Midwest than they are in Florida. Now, why is that? It's probably because of uncoordinated care, that people in Miami go to specialists without any coordination of care. And we've seen that in Intermountain or in Geisinger or in Mayo Clinic, if you have a quarterback of the care, someone, there's a thing called a patient-centered medical home. So if you better coordinate the care of people and not just let people go to every specialist, you can actually have better outcomes at less cost. Now, what I'm worried about is that most people, lay people, think more is always better. And that's just not true. More can create iatrogenic illness. I mean, I don't want to be in the hospital. I want to stay out of the hospital and stay healthy.
So I guess the really big challenge here then is educating the public, because if the clamor...
It's not just the public. I'm sorry. It's okay. All of us. All of us have to change. Doctors have to change, because if you read the Atal Gawande New Yorker article, sometimes we overuse tests and we overuse medical imaging and we overuse surgery. So doctors have to change. Government has to change. Employers have to change. And patients have to change. So I wouldn't just lay it on the patients if I were you. I think everybody has to change.
But isn't there something about our system that is somewhat of a perverse incentive in terms of fee for service, so people are doing more because they're getting paid more?
That's exactly right. And if you read the Atal Gawande article about McAllen, Texas, he shows that in some places in America, physicians are overutilizing tests to make more money. Now, not everywhere, but that is occurring. So if you look at the federal health care reform law, there's a lot of pilot projects about having CMS or Medicare pay for stuff not on a fee-for-service basis, but pay for stuff on a global payment in what's called an accountable care organization. Now, what's an accountable care organization? Some people have said they're like unicorns. Everyone talks about them, but no one's ever seen one. But what an accountable care organization is supposed to be is a new legal structure. Probably involves a hospital, probably some doctors, probably some hospice care. And they would then get a global payment for everything, the care of a defined population, say the people of Syracuse. So what that would do is no longer would a doctor order too many tests because he wouldn't get any extra money. Mm-hmm. It's almost like capitation, but right. People don't like the word capitation because they have bad memories of that. An ACO is an accountable care organization, which is a legal structure that would accept a global payment, which would replace the fee-for-service system. And then you would accept the global payment, but then you'd have to divvy up that money to the hospital, to the nurses, to the doctors, to the pathologist, to the surgeon. And that's going to be really interesting because each of those components think that they deserve more money than anybody else. But it's an idea to try to get the incentives aligned with prevention as opposed to overuse. So basically, that's in the new healthcare law. There'll be some pilot projects, and there already are some pilot projects about creating accountable care organizations, which would provide better coordinated care in a way that would have just as high a quality but lower cost.
Well, that makes, you know, incredible sense. And obviously, we've been failing miserably in that regard because, as we say, the costs just keep rising in an unsustainable way. I mean, you mentioned earlier that states are having problems with Medicaid, for example. I mean, Andrew Cuomo, our new governor, just came out and made a statement very recently that that the increases on an annual basis are unsustainable in Medicaid costs, and they're just going up, you know, wildly. So obviously something very different has to take place. And you feel that the new health care reform bill is really addressing that successfully.
I mean, it's not the bill I would have written,
okay,
but it clearly is one way to do it. Now, we have an interesting uncertainty is that two federal judges have said the health care bill is constitutional. Two federal judges have said the health care bill is unconstitutional. So the most powerful person in the country today for health care reform is Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who will decide either to go 5-4 one way or the other. But, you know, it's interesting that some of the federal judges have said that the individual mandate, so the federal government requiring all of us to have health care insurance, is unconstitutional. Others have said it is constitutional. You really have to have an individual mandate, I think, in order to have a large enough pool of people so that health care insurance works. I mean, if you don't have an individual mandate, then people won't buy health care insurance until they're sick, and then it doesn't work financially. So it's going to be really interesting. But, you know, it's always like this. If you go back and study how Social Security was put in by FDR, several Supreme Court justices were against it. There were lots of lawsuits about it. And it took several years for Social Security, which we now accept as the law of the land. So this is not, it's not really unusual that there's so much partisanship. If you go back to 1965, when Medicare was first put into place, the exact same thing. People saying it was the end of the world, it was socialized medicine, and now everybody likes Medicare and Social Security in general.
So basically,
America has to understand that it can't spend more money than it has.
Yep, absolutely. But like you said, that at this point it's the law of the land and such an invested entitlement that, you know, you would have to, I don't know what, blow up the government to make any changes in Medicare or Social Security. I mean, no one wants to put their political future on the line by trying to make those, you know, changes to entitlements. Let me get to a little different subject now. We alluded to the fact that there is kind of a movement in this country, consumer-driven, for patient-centered care. Tell me some of your thoughts about what constitutes patient-centered care and how that will play a role in this whole emerging change.
Well, I think patients and anybody who's tried to navigate the healthcare system with a chronic illness probably finds that it's difficult to navigate. And so patients are voting with their feet. I mean, right now, more patients go to alternative medicine healers, such as aromatherapists and chiropractors and other folks, than to primary care physicians. So in some sense, traditional medicine has failed patients because they feel that they're not getting what they want. If you look at how many patients go to health food stores and buy herbal supplements and natural remedies.
Which are unregulated.
Don't know what you're and what you don't know what you're getting. Right. It's a little bit scary.
Yep.
So patients have already decided that. Also, you have now what's called Web 2.0. So patients are going online to social media network sites like Patients Like Me or Diabetes Mine, and they're really learning from other patients how to deal with their chronic disease. That makes us doctors a little uncomfortable because we're not used to people talking to other patients before they come to us. I mean, it's really interesting. If you look at many, many more patients are Googling their symptoms and coming up with what they think they have before they even see a doctor, you can't stop that. I don't know if it's good. I don't know if it's bad. It's happening. And so I think that traditional medicine is going to have to change to probably embrace that in a way where the doctor and the patient become much more partners. Now, I also think patients have to understand that more isn't always better, and that even if you just Google your symptoms, you don't always come up with the right diagnosis. And there's a lot of misinformation on the internet as well. So the internet's not a totally good thing. It's a tool. It can be used to help patients, or it can be used to misinform patients. But I think you're going to see a real change in the doctor-patient relationship, and it's not being controlled by hospitals or health insurance or the government or doctors. It's being controlled by people that are all buying cell phones. I mean, listen, last week, the 10 billionth with a B smartphone app was downloaded from the Apple Store. And a bunch of those apps for smartphones have to do with weight control or hypertension or diabetes control, even sleep hygiene. So this is going to change the way medicine is practiced and the way people take care of themselves. So we're really in a very exciting time.
I agree. I think it's not only, obviously, it's changing the way governments are functioning. It's toppling governments. So we know that the internet and social media and access to information is really making a huge impact in our world. Clearly, it's going to have an impact on medical care and healthcare delivery going forward. And I want to get more specific about that in a minute. But in something I read that you had written, you talked about how institutions should change to be more they should reflect certain values that would make them more patient-centered. For example, patients should participate in rounds or in when they're in a hospital to be able to choose how they dress, for example.
Sure. Don Berwick, who's now the administrator at CMS or Medicare, is a great pediatrician and was president of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He wrote an article that I quoted in Health Affairs about how patient-centered care really would be really patient-driven, and that maybe even what the patient wants should trump evidence-based medicine. So he wrote that if you really had patient-centered care, then it would be like the doctors and hospitals would be guests in the patient's care where they're the hosts. So again, he said that patients should be able to choose their own clothes, eat their own food, even participate in rounds, or even participate in lean redesign mechanisms. So this is now the person who's running CMS. That's pretty unusual and pretty powerful. But I think a lot of it is cultural. And I've also written a lot about how we need to change the culture of healthcare. And let me give you an example. Sony had Walkman, and Sony had the technology to do iPods long before Apple did, but they couldn't do it because the culture of Sony was, we have to really make Walkman successful. Well, they don't make the Walkman anymore. And so digital music is now not done by Sony. It's done by Apple. Kodak, which I think is around here, had the first technology
we know
to
well.
Have a digital camera.
Yeah.
And how many people own a digital camera by Kodak today? Nobody. And that's because the culture at Kodak was film-oriented. Well, just a few months ago, they processed the last Kodak film, and it's gone. So Kodak didn't have a culture that embraced change. And what Clay Christensen, who writes about change in lots of different industries, has said, those that are leaders in the old paradigm rarely are leaders in the new paradigm.
That's interesting.
So could medical schools or could successful medical practices be the leaders. Maybe not. Maybe it's going to come from outside medicine, just like iPods are now manufactured by Apple, not Sony, and nobody owns a digital camera made by Kodak.
That's very, very interesting. We'll have to see how that plays out. You see solutions to this in terms of new roles and responsibilities for doctors, though? I mean, obviously, whether the doctors are actually the movers and shakers to make the change, you see that they have to change.
I think doctors have to change. I mean, I don't think doctors can continue to not practice evidence-based medicine and overutilize tests. I think we haven't even talked about comparative effectiveness research, which is part of the federal program, where we need to know what treatments actually do work. And maybe we ought to have CMS only pay for treatments that work. That's a little bit controversial. I think as an evidence-based medicine professional, I'm disturbed that we really don't have the answer to everything that we should have in an evidence-based way. So I think doctors are going to have to change. And look, doctors are not the most progressive group. I mean, we're not used to saying, I don't know. We're not used to saying, I don't know how to use Twitter. We're not used to saying, gee, maybe the patient does have a point when they bring this in off of Facebook. So as a professional group, though, I think that we'll probably do much better to not fight it, but to embrace it, because I think doctors have a tremendous amount of perspective and knowledge that could help empowered patients do a better job of taking more responsibility for their care. But if we fight it, we're going to end up being on the wrong side of it.
Stay with us. More from Dr. Bottles coming right up. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Simone Seward, an instructor in public health and preventive medicine at Upstate, with the Healthy Monday Minute for February 3rd. Scrutinize your symptoms. Headaches, indigestion, loss of appetite, muscle tension, sleep issues, and other allergic reactions could actually be signs of stress. Giving yourself time to pause, consider the situation, and breathe deeply when you encounter these signals is the first step towards finding the cause and limiting it for the future. Write down any unresolved symptoms that you experienced this week, along with the situation that may have sparked them. Then consult with a professional who can help you develop better coping strategies. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
If you're just joining us, this is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and I'm Linda Cohen speaking with Dr. Kent Bottles, a physician executive and medical visionary who was recently a guest speaker at Upstate. We were talking about the point that doctors have to change. Well, one of the biggest ways that I think we all have to change is to become more comfortable with all of the technology that's now at our fingertips. And as you said, unless you're of the maybe in your 20s, you didn't grow up with the kind of technology that's now available. So we have a whole system of people who are working with patients who really don't have that experience or expertise. And yet this type of technology is really at the forefront of how we can affect efficiencies. Now, you alluded in the earlier in this interview to using the smartphone and the various apps, as we call them, that can be downloaded. Let's talk more about that. What kinds of things really do you think could be helpful to a patient? What kinds of tools do we have today that could be helpful to patients?
Well, I think that there's a lot of applications that are out there. And I think I mentioned that 10 billion have been downloaded from the Apple Store. But the ones that I'm interested in and have been looking at in terms of smartphone apps is there's a whole bunch of apps around losing weight and obesity. So there's, I mean, your smartphone, whether you realize it or not, has a GPS and a motion sensor. You can have an app that turns your smartphone into a great pedometer. Right there. So the idea is what's happening is that everything is going to be in your smartphone. There will be no more laptop computers. I didn't bring a laptop when I flew up here yesterday. I just brought my smartphone. And so one thing is there's a whole bunch of things around exercise where there's apps where you can keep track of how many times you exercise and how many calories there are and everything. So that's one thing. I used to work on the 12th floor of an office building in Minneapolis. I could, with a smartphone app, figure out how many pounds I would lose if I used the stairs every day, twice a day. So that's kind of interesting. It's also, when say I'm in the market and I'm worried about salt. That just came out yesterday. I know this is Salt City, so sorry.
Not but, that we eat, though. We put it on the streets.
But salt is supposed to be bad for you. So they just came out with new dietary guidelines that you should have less salt. Well, I can, if I'm shopping for a new product, can use the barcode to augment onto my smartphone how much salt is in the stuff I'm going to buy. I'm going to buy a new product. That's pretty interesting. There are smartphone applications for diabetics. So the smartphone can become a very useful glucometer or a way to store all of your blood sugar levels. There's actually a sleep hygiene smartphone application that's one of the most popular in the Apple Store. So I really think there's lots of things. If you think about, we have to lose weight, we have to exercise more, we have to eat more intelligently, that the smartphone can be really, really useful. And what this really is, this gets to Web 3.0, which is augmented reality. Augmented reality means that with your smartphone, you can suddenly take all the information that's available on the web and have it wherever you are with your smartphone. There's a company called Layar, L-A-Y-A-R, which is in Holland. If you take a picture of a building in Holland with your smartphone, it suddenly identifies for you the name of the building, will tell you how many apartments are in that building, which ones are open, and you hit a thing, you can talk about renting the four-bedroom apartment. Mm. That's a mashup, and if you think about, well, how could we use a mashup of everything that's known for healthcare into your smartphone? And so the idea is the doctor or the patient, right at the time when they're buying the product in the grocery store, or right at the time when the doctor's prescribing the antibiotic, has the latest, greatest scientific medicine from the mashup of everything on the web that's delivered to him in real time so that he or she can order the right antibiotic for you.
Yes, so they can have Hippocrates or
up to date,
all sure. of that stuff readily available. So those are wonderful, wonderful breakthroughs. The question that comes to mind, the pitfall to my mind is, how can we vet this information? We really need to know, especially a layperson really needs to know that the information that they're receiving has been vetted and that it is credible.
It's a really interesting question. And there was a lot of controversy when Wikipedia first came out that, well, Encyclopedia Britannica was better because it was written by experts. But then there was an interesting study which showed that the Encyclopedia Britannica had about the same level of errors as Wikipedia. That even when the experts write it, that errors creep in for whatever reason. But the interesting thing about Wikipedia was the errors that come into Wikipedia are usually fixed because so many people are upgrading it all the time, and the errors that creep into Encyclopedia Britannica don't get fixed till the next edition. So let's be clear. There's never been totally vetted, perfect truth. If you've discovered that, Linda, please send me an email because it would be nice to have. Think about it, that there are mistakes done everything. But you're right. There's a lot of misinformation on the internet.
So we have to be educated consumers. Or
we have to be very skeptical, educated consumers, but also about the medical breakthroughs that are put out in JAMA or in the New England Journal of Medicine.
I know.
There was a fascinating article by that Greek fella who said, you know, these medical breakthroughs, almost half of them were overturned within 5 years. Well, why is that? That's because medical journal, even peer-reviewed journals, don't publish negative findings. They only publish positive findings. So we have these associations. Coffee causes pancreatic cancer. Coffee doesn't cause pancreatic cancer. And until it gets all sorted out in the medical literature, it's really hard to know. So yes, we all have to be very skeptical consumers of medical information.
I think that's a very key point that you're making. And also, we don't know who's underwriting research sometimes in terms of whether there's any kind of an interest promoting the certain results.
Well, we're just now discovering. And one thing I can tell you is transparency is not going away. And so you have ProPublica now publishing on their website all of the payments from drug companies to doctors. And it turns out that some of the doctors hadn't told their deans they were getting these and they were in violation of their conflict of interest rules. That's interesting. No one ever knew about that before because there wasn't the transparency of the internet. I mean, the internet really changes everything.
It does, absolutely. And we're witnessing it as we speak with world-changing events. I mean, it is amazing.
So you can say that's challenging and that rocks my world and I'm upset. Or you can say, boy, that's interesting. Can I better use those technological tools to take better care of patients? Because we're not perfect right now. I would like to say the latter rather than the former. I'd like to be optimistic that maybe it's great if a patient can use a smartphone as a pedometer and lose some weight.
I think that's fabulous. Let me turn to another subject, and that has to do with electronic medical records. It seems to me that that is going to be potentially a tremendous, not only a cost saving, but an efficiency in terms of nationwide care, in terms of being able to have these health information networks where if you're a patient in Syracuse and you're in New Mexico and you should have a cardiac incident, they can pull all your records up in New Mexico. And that's a goal, it seems to me.
Right. Easy to say, hard to do. The Obama administration is putting billions of dollars through ONC into getting everybody an electronic medical record. Ultimately, great idea. And I think it's a great idea because it will allow us to decrease per capita cost and increase quality. The problem is, just like with everything we do, we overemphasize the hype about how fast that's going to happen, and we underemphasize how important. 10 years ago, we did the genome. It's been 10 years, and we haven't got personalized medicine yet, right? We only have Gleevec and Herceptin,
right?
A couple of drugs. Okay. But and so by now, we all predicted that we'd all have personalized medicine, know the genes that caused every asthma or diabetes. It's been more complicated than that. So what I worry about is that HIT is very useful. We have to do it. But there's a long learning curve that physicians are less efficient for a long time till they understand how to use it. And the other thing is, it's not perfect, that it introduces a whole new set of errors because now we're using the computer. So it's like, I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be transformative. But it's not going to happen as fast as everybody's saying it is. And I worry about that we're using these, system-wide kind of platforms where I think perhaps everyone's going to have their personal health record on their smartphone. And so I worry about that we may be wasting some money investing in these system-wide, large systems of HIT. But yes, it'll be very useful.
Well, you also have the issue of compatibility. And that's something that I think is a great challenge, to have a nationwide system that is compatible, that can talk to its, each other.
Yeah, and Americans aren't so happy about having a nationwide system of anything.
I mean, there's a lot of paranoia there.
There's a lot of paranoia, and you see that out there. I was in the hotel this morning, and it sounds like somebody's trying to – there was an ad I saw in New York saying – it was a woman grocery shopping, and she was saying, I don't want the government telling me what to buy in my grocery basket. Well, that, I think, right there shows you the partisanship of some of us don't want the government telling us anything, but others of us want the government to have a safety net, and boy, don't take away my Social Security or my Medicare. So we are kind of schizophrenic as a people.
Absolutely.
Saying, let's get rid of the deficit, but don't touch Medicare. I mean, so you know,
or
to
don't
me,
touch taxes.
Right. And yeah, so do all those things, but never raise taxes.
Right.
So, if you know how to do that, Linda, again, send me an email.
All right, I'll remember that. Two other very quick things I want to try to cover, and that is this whole very interesting area of using robots and the whole virtual reality issue. But let's start with the robots. I have some personal experience. I have a kid training in medicine in Boston, and I know for a fact that at the Boston VA, they have robots delivering meds to patients.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, if you think about it, we have a primary care shortage. We have all these baby boomers like me retiring. We're not going to have enough primary care. And so there are some people in Boston, Dr. Kevdar is probably the leading expert at the Connected Health Institute at Partners, who is saying we're going to now have robots that are like people. And this is a little hard for most of us to get our arms around. But they claim that they've had a study where for discharge planning, real patients in Boston preferred the robot to the woman nurse
that is
explaining discharge planning.
I'm sorry.
But if you think about it, it does make some sense in the sense that the patient said, hey, the robot has all the time in the world. The robot didn't get upset when I repeated my question over and over again. And the robot didn't talk down to me. So this is and we can talk forever about this, but I think robots are going to have a larger role than we think about in the future. But it kind of does really rock my world in the sense of I would like to kind of have a person talking to me and feel empathy for me.
Well, we do have the mid-level providers who I think are you know, rising in importance in terms of stepping in to roles to help with the shortage of doctors. So,
oh, absolutely. I think you're going to see more and more nurse practitioners and PAs deliver primary care. Again, Clay Christensen's book, The Innovator's Prescription, talks a lot about you can deliver care if you have an algorithmic rule that you can do it, and that's what they're doing at CVS and other pharmacies where they deliver care through nurse practitioners.
Yeah, that's clearly going to be important, and we're doing that here at Upstate. As a matter of fact, Upstate has an EMR system that's in for its outpatient services that's going to be fully functional in 2011 and hopefully have an inpatient system after that. So we're trying to keep up with all of these changes. Tell me about avatars. There's been some research showing that people can use avatars to actually feel better about themselves. I mean, does it have to do with psychiatric issues or...
Avatars is a representation of yourself, like on Second Life or in a video game. So there's now some people saying that video games are addictive. People love them. And there's been a little bit of study, mostly out of California, of course, where is if I make an avatar of myself,
makes sense.
I'll have hair. I'll be very muscular. And yet what they've discovered is that if I start to interact with people as an avatar that's more attractive, it actually does then make me more confident and have higher self-esteem in real life. So we're just starting to understand all of this stuff around avatars and Second Life and real life, and it's very confusing.
Very confusing, but also exciting, I think. I mean, I recently heard a story about someone who is housebound and who's developed a whole world using SimCity. And
absolutely.
Somehow it's given her hope. Well, Dr. Kent Bottles, physician, educator, health systems consultant, and obvious visionary, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you,
Linda. You've been amazing, and we're very, very excited to hear all that you have to say. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, Upstate's literary and visual arts journal. Today we're going to talk about something funny. It's a serious subject when we deal with health, obviously, but there are rules about how to be ill. And we have a wonderfully funny poet named Johanna Shapiro from the West Coast, who's obviously spent some time in hospitals and has learned the tricks of the trade. We all know about the good patient, the good doctor. Well, here's a poem called Etiquette for the Very Ill by Johanna Shapiro. Let's say you get cancer or have a heart attack or get hit by a bus. You may think you need a doctor or a hospital, but what you really need is a lesson in etiquette. Otherwise, you will end up making a very bad impression on friends, family, doctors, nurses, and complete strangers, so that while struggling to live or struggling to die, you will also be universally perceived as completely lacking in decorum. Etiquette, that's right. By getting so sick, you've just committed a serious social faux pas. That's French for a very bad mistake, from which you will probably never recover. Ha ha. Generally speaking, as a very sick person, you want to avoid mordant humor. But what's a joke or two among friends? Believe me, when you are a very sick person, you need etiquette. Lesson number one. It is a good idea when you are desperately ill to know a little French. French is a classy language, and as a very ill person, it will give you a certain je ne sais quoi. That's French too. Look it up. If you do not already know French, you will have plenty of time to learn it in doctors' waiting rooms. Lesson number two. When you become a very ill person, it is most important that you avoid self-pity. This is a very disagreeable emotion to others. Also, anger, despair, misery, especially the wallowing kind, are bad. Bitter is very bad. When you show these emotions, you make healthy people feel guilty and uncomfortable. Healthy people can be unkind. They have plenty of energy. Lesson number three. As you might imagine, smiling is never out of place. If you aren't very ill yet, try smiling as you stick a needle, an ordinary sewing needle is fine, under your fingernail. You can add thank you later. If you allow yourself to become a very ill person who behaves badly, then it will end very badly for you, because everyone will despise you for having atrocious manners. On the other hand, it will probably end very badly for you anyway.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine the pitfalls of weight regain after bariatric surgery. Plus, we'll explore how you can keep your children safe from the hazards of lead poisoning. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.